Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone, and it's time for Making Sense with Steve Laser. I'm your host, Steve Laser, and I thank you for deciding to spend the next hour with me. I want to issue a special welcome to the show to those folks who are listening for the first time in the Inland Empire area of California on KCAA Radio 1050 AM. I hope you'll enjoy the show and hope you tune in regularly. Since many of you are listening for the first time, I want to explain how my show works. The show, quite simply, is about making sense in politics. I know, strange concept, right? Or also pointing out when things don't make sense. Most weeks, I cover what I think are the top three important political stories from the previous week. I'll give a perspective on those issues that's backed up by facts and sources, and that I will lace with what I hope you'll find, at least, is entertaining and often ironic humor. Now, in addition to those three top stories, the show will usually end with my trademark Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and other prominent individuals who either did something so smart and clever that it made great sense, or something so crazy and wrong that it made shameful nonsense. Now, I get to have a lot of fun with those pieces, particularly the Hall of Shame pieces, and I hope you'll find them a lot of fun, too. All of the segments usually have a fun and ironic side to them. But today's show is a little bit different, because we're at the 10-year anniversary of a really important event in American history. I have very strong opinions about that, and I will say some things about it that you in all likelihood have never heard before. I'll also make some heavy accusations against several people in the process. Now, I'll take you through it so that you can see that everything that I'm saying is supported by the facts. But make no mistake, that while the accusations that I will be leveling are strong, they are what should be the logical consequence of serious and willful wrongdoing. Wrongdoing that should concern every American, because it was done in our name, and it put the credibility of the United States on the line for something that turned out to be a lie. So our first segment will be about the 10th anniversary of what should have prevented the Iraq War. And be ready for the fireworks I just mentioned when I talk about that. After that, we'll talk about waking up to the reality of the sequester. And then we'll discuss Chuck Hagel's confirmation as Secretary of Defense after a bizarre few weeks of Republican shenanigans. And as mentioned earlier, we will finish with our trademark weekly Hall of Fame and Shame for those politicians and prominent individuals who made great sense or shameful nonsense, respectively. But first, before we get started, a word from one of our sponsors. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze diamond jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, B-A-D-L-E-R.com, or search Blaze diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R. First up, we have the 10th anniversary of what should have prevented the Iraq War. I really enjoyed Rachel Maddow's February 18th showing of Hubris, the story of how the Bush administration sold the Iraq War to the public. Now, being perfectly honest, not much in it was new for me, but it was so great to see someone in the mainstream media lay it out like Rachel did. And I get the feeling that many people in this country don't know how ugly that whole Iraq War thing was. Now, in fact, even what Rachel showed on her show doesn't completely shut the door on any argument in favor of what the Bush administration did because of one particular thing that she didn't talk about. Now, I'm going to get to that in a minute because that one thing happens to be the thing I've been talking about in articles and blog posts for the last 10 years. But first, let's sum up what Rachel talked about in Hubris. First, Rachel highlighted how the Bush administration wanted to invade Iraq from the moment that they were elected. In fact, members of what would be the Bush administration, who were part of a conservative foreign policy group called PNAC, the Project for a New American Century, they've been arguing for invading Iraq and removing Saddam Hussein since 1998. Rachel showed a 1998 letter from what would be several members of the Bush administration members to President Clinton trying to get him to attack Iraq way back then. Rachel then showed us a confidential memo from Dick Cheney shortly after the Bush administration took office in January 2001, where he outlines what kind of excuses could be used to attack Iraq. And conspicuous on that list was a suggestion that Iraq could be said to have weapons of mass destruction. Rachel went through several key pieces of intelligence and showed how the Bush administration, particularly folks like Dick Cheney, Donald Rumsfeld, Douglas Feith, and other folks in the National Security Wing of the White House, knowingly put forth faulty intelligence in order to make the case for Iraq. Now, Rachel makes the point that the White House insiders, as I call them, even duped Colin Powell and some Republican members of Congress with faulty intelligence. Okay, so those are the items that Rachel proved in her show Hubris. So let me get into some of the additional things that I see as critical parts of what happened. But first, yes, it's true, most politicians in the United States of both parties and most politicians throughout the world thought that there was a good chance that Saddam Hussein had in fact resumed a weapons of mass destruction program after the UN weapons inspectors left Iraq in 1998. Now, those UN inspectors left, by the way, because the Iraqis had stopped cooperating with them. Now, shortly after they left, we bombed Iraq as punishment for that non-cooperation. Now, that non-cooperation is what made people suspicious, and it continued from 1998 until November 2002. That's 4 years during which Iraq had no weapons inspectors on the ground. Now, that's reasonable suspicion considering Saddam Hussein's track record. That kind of suspicion is what allows most law enforcement groups around the world to solve crimes. They ask people questions until they find that someone has lied or is hiding something. If someone's hiding something or refusing to come clean about something, there's usually a reason. So that suspicion, plus the faulty intelligence provided by the Bush administration, is why countries like Syria, China, Russia, France, all 13 permanent and non-permanent members of the UN Security Council in November of 2002, voted in favor of UN Security Council Resolution 1441 that declared Iraq in non-compliance with terms of the ceasefire from the first Gulf War. So that suspicion plus the faulty intelligence that was fed them is also why some Democrats in the House and Senate voted for the Iraq War Resolution. Those two actions, UN Security Council Resolution 1441 and the Iraq War Resolution, were voted on by people who believed that they were voting to put pressure on Iraq to allow the UN weapons inspectors back into the country. That's what those two resolutions, one international and one U.S.-based, were about. And they worked. Those resolutions were passed within a few days of each other in mid to late November of 2002, and by the end of November, Iraq had agreed to let the weapons inspectors back into the country, and the first UN weapons inspectors, in fact, arrived before the 1st of December 2002. Now, this is something I want everyone to understand. If we had a decent person in the White House and a decent administration, that would have essentially been the end of it. What 99% of the world's governments and politicians wanted was to ensure Iraq's compliance with UN resolutions regarding Iraq's weapons programs. The UN weapons inspectors went in, and they proceeded to check every site that it was believed might contain a weapons program. And they didn't find any, of course. They searched for 3 months, and they believed that they were getting adequate cooperation. Now, as I've written in several articles and blog posts, what should have been treated as a terrific success, and basically the end of things, getting the UN weapons inspectors back into Iraq, instead didn't seem to make the Bush administration happy. In fact, they then ratcheted up the rhetoric for military action against Iraq, and they built up U.S. forces in the region to do it. They sent Colin Powell to address the UN with more faulty intelligence, And Bush gave the State of the Union address in the United States and issued a statement about Iraq trying to obtain significant quantities of uranium from Africa. Those things happened in January and February of 2003. The UN weapons inspectors had already been in Iraq for over 2 months when those statements were made. And the inspectors, as we all know, didn't find anything during those months because nothing was ever found. So if you're trying to make excuses for the Bush administration, like many Republicans do when I talk to them about Iraq, how do you reconcile those things? You have a group of people who are trained to spot and identify hidden weapons programs on site, making examinations, and not finding anything, and yet you're claiming to the entire world that these weapons exist. Nor can you blame Democrats in Congress who voted for the Iraq War Resolution, unless you're essentially going to accuse the entire rest of the world's governments and politicians for believing the same thing those Democrats did and wanting the same thing those Democrats did, namely putting pressure to get the UN weapons inspectors back into Iraq. In the beginning of March 2003, the Bush administration told the UN that they needed to pull the weapons inspectors out of Iraq because military action was imminent. The UN complied. But head weapons inspectors Hans Blix and Mohammed El-Baradei did something very important upon leaving. They compiled a report with their findings since arriving in Iraq and on March 7th delivered a report to the United Nations General Assembly. Those reports have been available ever since on the UN website. Let me read you some excerpts. Since the arrival of the first inspectors in Iraq on 27 November 2002, UNMOVIC has conducted more than 550 inspections covering approximately 350 sites. Of those, 44 sites were new sites. All inspections were performed without notice, and access was in virtually all cases provided promptly. In no cases have the inspectors seen convincing evidence that the Iraqi side knew in advance of their impending arrival. Top UN nations weapons inspector Hans Blix told the Security Council that after 3 months of intrusive inspections, we have to date found no evidence or plausible indication of the revival of a nuclear weapons program in Iraq. Iraq has been forthcoming in its cooperation, particularly with regard to the conduct of private interviews and in making available evidence that could contribute to the resolution of matters of IAEA concern. I do hope that Iraq will continue to expand the scope and accelerate the pace of its cooperation. And turning to biological and chemical weapons, Mr. Blix said there was significant Iraqi effort underway to clarify a major source of uncertainty as to the quantities of those arms, which were unilaterally destroyed in 1991. As part of that effort, a disposal site was now being re-excavated, unearthing bombs and fragments which could allow the determination of the number of bombs destroyed at that site. Mr. Blix emphasized that no evidence had so far been seen of weapons of mass destruction being moved around by truck or of mobile production units for biological weapons, or of underground facilities for chemical or biological production or storage, as claimed by intelligence authorities. Now, I want to make it clear to you all that those reports were issued March 7, 2003, 12 days before U.S. and U.K. forces attacked Iraq, and they were read publicly on that date by Mr. Blix and El-Baradei at the U.N. General Assembly and televised live so the entire world could see them. Now, I have been following the reports of the weapons inspectors. I'm a political junkie. I had a blog at the time, which is still accessible on the Internet, so I'll have a link to it and the text of it on my new blog by the end of the day on Monday. But on March 9th, 2 days after the UN weapons inspectors issued their reports and 10 days before we attacked Iraq, I wrote this on my blog. Iraq is now cooperating. They're destroying missiles. Their scientists are disclosing all in interviews, and it seems they were not working anywhere near as intently as we were led to believe to develop nuclear weapons. So we're not going to war, right? Wrong. In perhaps the most stunning display that all we have been told regarding why we're going to war in Iraq against Iraq is total balderdash. Colin Powell and W are indicating war is right around the corner, if not that plans are being stepped up. Now, what does this tell us about the people who are leading our country? It tells us that Bush, Cheney, Rice, Powell, and Rumsfeld are willing to kill hundreds of thousands of people and put hundreds of thousands of our men and women in uniform in harm's way to prosecute a war against a nation that does not present a clear and present danger to the United States or our allies. Bush and any Bush administration official who stands by the president on this issue after the war begins should be impeached and sent to The Hague to stand trial for war crimes and crimes against humanity. Am I being too strong? I don't think so. Our Constitution talks about the inalienable rights of all people to life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. War and killing go completely contrary to those basic rights, and it's because of this that past great leaders of our country have established terms like clear and present danger to put a moral qualification as to what kind of threat another nation has to pose to us or our allies before we can morally resort to war. A proposed war against Iraq barely had a whiff of such justification before the latest weapons inspector's report. Now, any hint of such justification is gone. Americans of all parties, backgrounds, religions, and ideologies need to rise up in protest against this war, because once it starts, whatever else this war will cost us, it will cost us our national honor. That was my blog post from March 9, 2003, and I've never changed my mind about those sentiments. Unfortunately, I think I was exactly right that war has cost the United States our national honor. We went to war on a justification of Iraq having weapons of mass destruction when those in charge of our government knew from the March 7th UN weapons inspector reports that no such weapons would be found. There's no excuse for that. After the March 7 weapons inspector reports, you can't say that the Bush administration selectively believed the intelligence that they were peddling. They had a factual report in front of them that told them what trained weapons inspectors had seen with their own eyes on the ground in Iraq. I don't know why this weapons inspector's angle hasn't been talked about more in the press since then. Those reports are a smoking gun. They're a slam dunk on any possibility to justify what Bush, Cheney, Rumsfeld, Feith, and the rest of that group did with regards to Iraq. If you go to war when you're not being threatened and without UN sanction, you have engaged in an unprovoked war of aggression. That's one of the war crimes that we charged high-ranking Nazis with after the Second World War. It is a war crime to engage in an unprovoked war of aggression. Now, Republicans are fond of saying that the Iraq War was worth it because we got rid of Saddam Hussein, and they challenge dissenters like me by asking us, would we rather Saddam Hussein still be in power? So let me answer them. Yes, I would rather Saddam Hussein still be in power than to have it be known that a president of the United States, in this case President Bush, can commit the war crime of an unprovoked war of aggression. I would rather Saddam Hussein still be in power than to have our government on record as making bald-faced lies to the entire world to justify a war. And yes, I would rather Saddam Hussein still be in power than to have our credibility and honor so demonstrably and horrifically self-impugned. I hope that answers the question for any Republicans hearing this. Making Sense with Steve Laser. We'll be right back. Welcome back. Hope I didn't scare you all off with that first segment. The deadline for Congress and the President to reach a compromise to avert the sequester and its painful budget cuts passed on Friday without an agreement. Now, in order to comply with the new law going into effect, as reported by CBS News and others, President Obama signed an order to begin the cuts as he is now required to do by law. Republicans don't seem to be able to decide whether the sequester is a good thing or not. Speaker Boehner has literally been all over the map on the sequester. At one point, he said he was really happy about it and that it represented 98% of what he wanted. Sometime later, Mr. Boehner said that it threatens U.S. national security, thousands of jobs, and more things that were terrible. Kentucky Senator Rand Paul said that, "I think the sequester happens and it will be in some ways a yawn." Alabama Congressman Mo Brooks said that he will continue to stand strong until the sequester is reversed. And like the GOP leader in the House, John Boehner, Mitch McConnell, the Republican Senate minority leader, has been all over the place on the sequester. At one point, he said the combat readiness of the armed forces will be severely cut as a result of the sequester, and later he seemed to downplay the effect, saying, quote, "It's absurd that the government cannot get by with a little more than a 2% reduction in spending," end quote. Now, Rand Paul was not alone among Republicans in saying that the sequester would be a yawn. And it's an easy claim to make for two reasons. Now, first, spending cuts will take a while to implement, and they'll take weeks more for the effects to make it to the broader economy. If you're not one of the people furloughed or laid off, you may not feel it for a while. The president himself alluded to this in his comments yesterday. Let's listen.
Good morning, everybody. As you know, I just met with leaders of both parties to discuss a way forward in light of the severe budget cuts that start to take effect today. At a time when our businesses have finally begun to get some traction, hiring new workers, bringing jobs back to America, we shouldn't be making a series of dumb, arbitrary cuts to things that businesses depend on and workers depend on, like education and research and infrastructure and defense. It's unnecessary, and at a time when too many Americans are still looking for work, it's inexcusable. Now, what's important to understand is that not everyone will feel the pain of these cuts right away. The pain, though, will be real. Beginning this week, many middle-class families will have their lives disrupted in significant ways. Businesses that work with the military, like the Virginia shipbuilder that I visited on Tuesday, may have to lay folks off. Communities near military bases will take a serious blow. Hundreds of thousands of Americans who serve their country, Border Patrol agents, FBI agents, civilians who work at the Pentagon, all will suffer significant pay cuts and furloughs. All of this will cause a ripple effect throughout our economy.
So yes, at first this is going to seem to the vast majority of Americans like it's not that big of a deal. But as I said in last week's show, the effect is like a reverse stimulus. A stimulus increases government spending to initiate some positive momentum in the economy. The effect of the sequester cuts, or reverse stimulus as I call it, will be to initiate negative momentum in the economy. It will tend to contract the economy, lower GDP, and cause jobs to be lost. Now, considering how our economy has been since 2007, it's a really bad idea to play games with it this way. Now, both the legislative and executive branch and both political parties deserve some blame here. But I do place more blame on the Republicans in the House than I do on other folks, because the president has had an offer on the table for more than a week that would have averted this crisis and put into place more measured cuts whose effects would not have been close to as severe as the sequester. And I posted that plan to the president's on my blog at stevelazer.blogspot.com. You can see it there. But another interesting artifact of the sequester is that I believe this is the first time in the history of our country that Congress has passed a massive cut in defense spending while we have troops in the field fighting the war, and in this case, Afghanistan. I think there's a good chance that Republicans in the Congress are going to get together with the president to fix this next week. The risks are just too great. If no deal ends up being made and the existing cuts stand, I predict that we will have at least a minor recession at some point in the next 4 to 6 quarters. Now, if you remember, a recession is 2 or more quarters in a row with negative GDP. In other words, half of a year or more with a shrinking economy. I think that's what will happen if the cuts are not reversed. If Congress and the president do get together to implement a compromise, please let it also deal with all of the other upcoming potential crises, like the debt ceiling. Let's end this crazy cycle where every few weeks we have another self-imposed budgetary crisis. That's no way to run an economy or a government. We'll be right back. Welcome back. With today's show, I'm introducing a new section called Listener Feedback. Now, this is a section where I will mention a couple of issues that I specifically want to hear back from you all, my audience, your opinions, how you feel about them, how you feel about how I raise the issues. And I will read some of your letters during a future show. And the email address for the show, if you want to talk about whatever we've talked about here, it doesn't have to be the items in this specific section. It could be anything else that I talk about in the show. But the email address is makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Again, makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. So feel free to write in and comment. Again, any part of the show, But, of course, the things I most want to hear your opinions on are the highlighted issues. And today we're going to highlight two issues in particular. First of all, the Bradley Manning situation and trial. And secondly, the flap about Bob Woodward and his claiming that he was threatened by the White House. Now, first, Bradley Manning. If you haven't heard about this, the facts of this situation are he is an E3, an airman first class, a private first class. I'm already getting confused with my prior military experience. I'm former Air Force. But Manning was a private first class, actually still is a private first class in the Army. He worked at the Pentagon in a position where he had access to all sensitive U.S. diplomatic communications and some Department of Defense communications through a system called CIPRNet. And one day, Mr. Manning downloaded years' worth of sensitive diplomatic communications and defense communications, and he took that information and he gave it to WikiLeaks after first trying to give it to the New York Times and at least one other mainstream media organizations who refused to print it without corroboration from another source. WikiLeaks, Julian Assange's organization, they accepted the information. They published it on their website with a searchable database. Now, that information has seriously harmed the United States' image abroad. It hurt American diplomats. It hurt the diplomats and government officials of many other countries, because our diplomats' communications with them were sent back through this CIPRNet and cataloged in a database that we have. And it almost certainly gave away information that would lead counterintelligence agencies of various countries to make it easier for them to find agents that we have overseas. Because some of the information that we got clearly came from intelligence sources, and particularly through things like, one of our intelligence agents might have been in a room when something was discussed. So counterintelligence agents from other countries can look at that and say, there was only 3, 4, 5 people in this room who could have heard it. This information got out, so one of those folks is a spy. So you never know when you release information like that, all the potential effects that could have. Now, Bradley Manning claims that he did this because he saw wrongdoing in at least some of the communications and at least one video that was in CIPRNet, and he wanted the world to know about it. He claims he's a whistleblower. His trial is going on right now. He's charged with dozens of counts, including, of course, unauthorized release of sensitive and classified information, but also aiding and abetting the enemy. And recently, he decided to plead guilty to many of the charges against him. And tell the truth and at least about that. And he claimed to the judge that he did all of this for the right reasons, and he pled not guilty to aiding the enemy. This all happened this week, and the judge ruled that the reasons that Manning gave are not an excuse for the things to which he pled guilty. And most trial watchers are of the opinion that means that Mr. Manning is in pretty deep trouble. I'm former military, and I did also see some wrongdoing, not this kind of wrongdoing, but someone doing something that they were not supposed to be doing. I informed a superior, and that superior went to the inspector general. They wrote a letter to the inspector general. The inspector general investigated, and it actually resulted in the demotion of two fairly high-ranking officers in this case. I don't want to give any more details for obvious reasons. The other thing that I would comment from my own personal experience is that when you enlist or commission in the military really does a good job of training you and explaining to you what will happen if you engage in wrongdoing. You see videos, you get all kinds of pamphlets. You're explained what the court-martial system is. You're explained wrongdoing in the military is vigorously punished. It's not something to play games with. They make that pretty clear from the get-go. But they also make clear what to do if you are a witness to wrongdoing. If you know of something that's going wrong, they give you multiple avenues to report it. There's obviously your chain of command, and for whatever reason here, Manning didn't feel comfortable using his chain of command. That's okay. There's also the Inspector General, though, which I've talked about before. Not only that, there are federal laws in place to where if you report wrongdoing, if you're in the military or a government employee, if you report wrongdoing to the Inspector General and to a congressperson, you cannot be prosecuted. You're protected as a whistleblower if you go that route. Now, the military, for their part, in the base newspaper, in repeated briefings, they emphasize the Inspector General as an avenue that you can go to report wrongdoing. There's a base Inspector General. Most units have an Inspector General. The entire services, there's an Army Inspector General, there's an Air Force Inspector General, major commands have Inspector Generals. There's different Inspector Generals that you can go to, and their entire job is to investigate and deal with wrongdoing. So this avenue was available to him. It was no doubt it was communicated to him multiple times, but he decided not to go that route. Now, there's obviously people on many different sides of this issue. I want to know what you all think. I want you to tell me how you feel about Bradley Manning and what he did and whether or not he should be punished. Some people think he's a hero. Some people think that he deserves to have the book thrown at him here. Email me, tell me what you think, and I'll read some of your letters during my next show. And the email address again is makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Now, Bob Woodward. Woodward, obviously, along with Bernstein, were one of the major folks that reported on wrongdoings in the Nixon administration and led to his resignation. And he recently wrote an article in the Post that suggested that the sequester was Obama's fault, and he accused the president of moving the goalposts by asking for more tax increases. Now, last week I talked about how the sequester came to be. I think it's unfair to blame it on anyone in particular, but if you recall, in July and August of 2011, the debt ceiling wasn't going to be raised by Republicans in Congress. We were going to default on our debts, and basically the Republicans held the president hostage to coming up with some sort of spending cuts before they would agree to pay the country's bills. Now, I don't know how you interpret the president coming up with something in a rush like that as his fault. I definitely think that maybe he should have waited a little bit longer and negotiated, but saying it's all his fault, I don't think is fair. But that's what Woodward wrote about. He accused the president recently of moving the goalposts by asking for more tax increases in the negotiations that are going on. And before he wrote this article, he attempted to get the White House comments before the piece was published. So he calls the White House, and supposedly an argument happened between Woodward and Obama's economic advisor, Gene Sperling. So far, no big deal, right? Those things probably happen all the time. But then Woodward goes on a media blitz, appearing on any political cable show that would have him, and claimed that the administration was intimidating reporters like Nixon did. So it turns out that Woodward got an email from Sperling after the argument, and Woodward was on Hannity's show and various other shows claiming that the email by Sperling said he would regret staking out the claim that he did. So there was a big hullabaloo this week. Everybody was talking about that. Oh, my God, the Obama administration is intimidating reporters. But then the email was made public. It was made public in the Huffington Post, and here's the exchange that Woodward said he interpreted as a threat. Now, first from Gene Sperling. Sperling says, "I apologize for raising my voice in our conversation today. I do understand your problems with a couple of our statements, but I feel, on the other hand, that you focus on a few specific trees that gives you a wrong perception of the forest. But perhaps we'll not see eye to eye here. But I truly believe that you should rethink your comment about saying that the president asking for revenues is moving the goalpost. I know you may not believe this, but as a friend, I think you will regret staking out that claim. My apologies again for raising my voice on the call with you. Feel bad about that and truly apologize." And Woodward replies, "Gene, you do not ever have to apologize to me. You get wound up because you are making your points and you believe them. This is all part of a serious discussion. I, for one, welcome a little heat. There should be more given the importance. I also welcome your personal advice." Now, I'm interested in hearing what you guys think about that exchange. Email me at makingsenseletters@yahoo.com. Do you think that was a threat, or do you think Bob Woodward overreacted? We'll be right back. What's the biggest fallacy about diamonds? More facets are better and will create more fire. Doesn't that make sense? Nothing could be farther from the truth. In fact, larger facets create more fire. The new Blaze Cut is a unique square diamond with a fabulous display of colors never before seen emanating from a diamond. In fact, the Blaze Diamond has 9 times the fire of any other round diamond of the same size. It took a genius to invent the Blaze Diamond, and an amazing artist to highlight the beauty in fine jewelry. View Blaze Diamond Jewelry by Bez Ambar on Badler.com, B-A-D-L-E-R.com, or search Blaze Diamond on YouTube to see remarkable videos. Experience this new innovation by coming to Maurice Badler Fine Jewelry in New York City, 485 Park Avenue between 58th and 59th Streets. Visit Badler.com for more information or call 800-M-BADLER. That's 800-M-B-A-D-L-E-R.
Hey now, you're an all-star. Get your game on, go play. Hey now, you're a rock star. Get the show on, get paid. All that glitters is gold.
Welcome back. On Tuesday, the Senate confirmed Chuck Hagel as our next Secretary of Defense. The Hagel confirmation is going to go down as one of the most nonsensical confirmation battles in the history of this country. You have a former Republican senator whose confirmation hearings were dominated by attacks on him by Republican senators and whose confirmation was held up by a filibuster of Republican senators. And the person in question being vetted for Secretary of Defense was a former enlisted Army soldier who saw combat in Vietnam, and the vast majority of the Republican senators who rose in opposition to him had never served in the military. And most of the reasons Mr. Hagel was opposed by those folks had nothing to do with whether he was qualified to assume the position to which he was being appointed. Think about all that for a moment. Former Republican, opposed by Republicans, filibustered by Republicans, war veteran opposed by defense position by folks who never served and whose competence was not really at issue. It's a dizzying array and display of crazy. Now, wait until you hear the reasons why he was opposed. First, his nomination was held up because Republicans in the Senate wanted the Obama administration to give them the White House emails on Benghazi. Now, don't think you've missed something if you're now scratching your head. You didn't miss anything. Hagel had nothing to do with Benghazi. He wasn't a member of the administration or any other part of the government at the time our consulate there was attacked. And he knows nothing about the Benghazi attacks. You see, Republicans just used the opportunity of Hagel's confirmation hearings to blackmail the White House into providing them the Benghazi emails, which, by the way, the White House provided on Monday because there's no there in Benghazi. I mean, this could be a whole other show, but Republicans are hoping Benghazi will provide a pretext under which they can initiate impeachment proceedings against President Obama. Now, they don't want to really remove him from office. They just want to hurt his presidency and hurt the ability of the 2016 Democratic nominee to succeed him, like they did with Clinton and Gore. But back to Hagel. In addition to Benghazi, John McCain was angry at Hagel for a perceived betrayal. Hagel was generally supportive of President Obama's candidacy in 2008 when McCain was the Republican nominee. And there are two things Senator McCain is known for in the Senate. He's known for his temper, and he's known for never forgetting a slight, whether real or imagined. In fact, Senator McCain specifically mentioned Hagel as an ideal prospect for Secretary of Defense back in 2000. Let's listen.
As far as Secretary of Defense is concerned, there's a lot of people that could do that. One of them, I think, is Senator Chuck Hagel.
So McCain clearly knows that Hagel is qualified, as do the rest of the Senate Republican caucus. The Republican opposition to Hagel was nonsense that wasted everybody's time. It's too bad we can't furlough Republicans in the House and Senate. If we could just furlough those folks for the sequester, President Obama and the Democrats in Congress could get most of the business of the country done in a few weeks. Making Sense with Steve Lazor. We'll be right back with our Hall of Fame and Shame after this. Welcome back, and now it's time for our Hall of Fame and Shame. First, our Hall of Fame for Making Sense. Two separate entities share the honor of winning our Hall of Fame for Making Great Sense this week. First, as reported in the New York Times, is a group of 75 Republicans who signed a brief asking the Supreme Court to uphold a ruling by a California appeals court striking down that state's Proposition 8 law that banned gay marriage. The Times listed some of the names as John Huntsman, Meg Whitman, Representatives Ileana Ross Lehtinen of Florida and Richard Hanna of New York, Stephen J. Hadley, who's a former Bush National Security Advisor, Carlos Gutierrez, a Commerce Secretary to Mr. Bush, James B. Comey, a top Bush Justice Department official, David A. Stockman, who is President Reagan's first budget director, and Deborah Price, a former member of the House Republican leadership from Ohio, who is retired from Congress. Now, these folks have done a brave thing, and they've done the right thing. It's a brave thing because a Republican who stands up to the Christian right in their party is usually completely finished politically, because that subset of the Republican Party is among the largest and also the most active in terms of critical political work, like providing campaign workers and things like getting out the vote. So their act of courage in doing the right thing gives this group a share of the Hall of Fame this week for Making Great Sense. Sharing honors with them for filing a similar amicus brief on the same side of things in the Proposition 8 case before the Supreme Court are President Obama and the administration. Now, this is the second week in a row that the administration has had at least a share of the Hall of Fame winnings. Last week, they won for an amicus brief in the other gay marriage case before the Supreme Court, and that was U.S. v. Windsor. And that's the case that may result in the striking down of at least Section 3 of DOMA, the Defense of Marriage Act. The administration continues to do the right thing and the logical thing to protect the equal rights of all Americans, as is our creed specified by our Bill of Rights and our Constitution. So, congratulations to President Obama and the administration for their share of winning this week's Hall of Fame for Making Sense. Now on to our Hall of Shame this week for infamous nonsense.
All aboard!
In third place this week, we have our Hall of Shame, we have New Jersey Governor Chris Christie. Now, I have a general policy on this show, and that policy states that when a Republican is doing the right thing, I stay out of their way, and I try not to make fun of them or question their motives. So, when I found out that New Jersey Governor Chris Christie was going to accept federal money from the Affordable Care Act to expand Medicaid coverage in his state, not only was I not going to point out that he's doing this after repeatedly attacking the Affordable Care Act, I was going to highlight Governor Christie in the Hall of Fame section. But when I listened to his comments, there's just a little bit too much wanting to have his cake and eat it too. Now, I get it, Governor Christie. You have clearly had some sort of epiphany in the last 6 months, and it shows with how you dealt with the aftermath of Hurricane Sandy and now being concerned about expanding health care coverage to poor people. That's great. You've seen the light. But you still need to survive as a Republican. And I get that that's got to be hard. But that's no excuse for saying this during your speech on the New Jersey budget. Let's listen.
It's simple. We're putting people first, which is why, after considerable discussion and research, I have decided to participate in Medicaid expansion under the Affordable Care Act. Accepting these federal resources will provide health insurance to tens of thousands of low-income New Jerseyans, help keep our hospitals financially healthy, and actually save money for New Jersey taxpayers. In fact, Taxpayers will save approximately $227 million in fiscal year 2014 alone. Now, let me also be clear. I am no fan of the Affordable Care Act. I think it's wrong for New Jersey, and I think it's wrong for America. I fought against it and believe in the long run it will not achieve what it promises. However, it is now the law of the land. And I will make all my judgments as governor based on what I believe is best for New Jersey.
So he hates the Affordable Care Act, thinks it's wrong for New Jersey, but he's accepting the money because it will help people in New Jersey and save New Jersey money. Governor Christie, you're doing the right thing. But it's either going to help New Jersey or it's going to hurt New Jersey. You can't say it's going to do both in almost the same sentence. It's clear what Governor Christie really thinks from listening to the whole speech. He says flat out that accepting the Affordable Care Act is going to save New Jersey $200 million of state taxpayer money, and it's going to result in 104,000 of the lowest income people in New Jersey to get on Medicare and have good health insurance. That's a good thing. That's a great thing. And the governor knows it. He also knows, however, that if he actually comes out and says that, his chance to win the 2016 Republican nomination for president will go from slim to none. Republicans have demonized the Affordable Care Act and said it is an evil thing, and any Republican who says anything good about it is considered a traitor. Now, that's despite the fact that I highlighted last week that in 2004, the Republican administration of George W. Bush set up a universal health care plan in Iraq for Iraqis. Republicans think the Iraqis deserve universal health care, but we in the U.S. do not, I guess. But getting back to Governor Christie, his talking out of both sides of his mouth on this issue doesn't really say much for someone who claims that he plays it straight and says what he really thinks. So Governor Christie is third this week in our hall of shame for making nonsense. In second place, for even worse nonsense this week, we have a tie between two folks who have exhibited racism and bigotry. They are blogger and fellow Blog Talk host Andrea Shea King and also Vera Eisenduren, the president of the San Bernardino County Federation of Republican Women. Now, I should have known what to expect from Andrea King when I learned that she has a regular weekly gig writing a column for WorldNet Daily. Regardless of what that rag claims to be, in reality, WorldNet Daily is an online conservative media outlet that is known for printing outlandish and unsupported conspiratorial garbage about Democrats and liberals that other conservative media find too crazy to publish. So you know the kind of things that are going to come from someone like that are going to be well into whack job territory. As reported by the blog ConWeb Watch in her February 26th blog post titled, "Why the Obsession with Straight-Haired Wigs, Michelle?" Ms. Shea went on a racist rant about First Lady Michelle Obama, where just about the only thing she held back was the N-word. She mentions three times that she thinks Michelle is self-loathing because she was born black. She talks about her being overweight, having a Cro-Magnon jaw and wide nose, and all that is in the first paragraph. It goes downhill from there. Now, before I get into the racist aspect of this, I think I have to point something out. I try to avoid talking about the physical appearance of those with whom I disagree. But in this case, Ms. Andrea King ripped apart someone else's appearance so badly, I think it's fair game to examine what she looks like in comparison. And by the way, there's nothing wrong with Michelle Obama. She's a beautiful lady. But Andrea King? No, she's not. She's definitely not someone who should be talking about other folks' physical appearance and beauty. And you know what? I've changed my mind. I'm going to leave it there. There's really no need for me to go on with what I was thinking about saying. You know, I was going to go into details, but I think that would just lower me to Ms. King's level. I'm going to end it there, and I'm simply going to say that for her disgusting and racist blog post, Ms. King is tied with for runner-up in this week's Hall of Shame for making nonsense. So sharing second place with her is Vera Eisenduren, She's the president of the San Bernardino County Federation of Republican Women. And as reported by San Francisco Gate, Ms. Eisendorn is not a fan of one of the candidates for vice chairperson of the California State Republican Party. That candidate is Harmeet Dhillon, a San Francisco attorney. Now, in a post on Facebook, Ms. Eisendorn said of Ms. Dhillon, quote, "I was told by one of Harmeet's friends that because of her religion, her loyalty is to the Muslim religion, so she will defend a Muslim beheading two men without any hesitation. She's not a Republican," end quote. Now, like the situation with Andrea King, beyond the racism and religious centrism exhibited by Ms. Eisendorn, there's a broader ignorance factor. You see, Ms. Dhillon is not Muslim. She's Sikh. The two religions, they're very different. Ms. Eisendorn can't even get bigotry right, and bigotry isn't exactly what you would call a practice that draws heavily on the intellect. San Bernardino Republicans, let's face it, you and I are obviously not going to be friends, right? And we're not going to agree on much. But you really ought to reconsider who represents your Federation of Women as its president. In any case, Ms. Eisendorn earns her spot along with Andrea King as runner-up in this week's Hall of Shame for making nonsense. Now, the award for worst and most shameful nonsense of the week goes to Supreme Court Justice Antonin Scalia. Now, this is at least the second time that Justice Scalia has made the Hall of Shame on my show. And he not only makes it tonight, but he wins it for his ridiculous assertion that the Voting Rights Act is, quote, a perpetuation of racial entitlement, end quote. Now, all Democrats in Congress and every Republican in the Senate and a vast majority of Republicans in the House of Representatives felt that there was a need to continue to have this law in effect. You see, the Voting Rights Act was initially passed in 1965 because southern states and certain other districts were passing laws deliberately aimed at stopping African Americans from voting. The act essentially requires those states and areas to get federal permission to alter their election laws. Now, each time the act has been renewed, Congress has had dozens of witnesses and tons of evidence submitted that not enough progress has been made to be able to ensure the franchise for African Americans in those states without federal oversight. In 2006, when it was last passed by Congress by such a large margin, nearly 100 witnesses testified before Congress and tens of thousands of supporting documents submitted with evidence of attempts in those affected states to restrict voting rights for African Americans. Now, knowing all of that, let's look at Scalia's broader statement. He said, quote, "I think it is attributable, very likely attributable, to a phenomenon that is called perpetuation of racial entitlement. It's been written about. Whenever a society adopts racial entitlements, it is very difficult to get out of them through the normal political processes. And I am fairly confident it will be reenacted in perpetuity unless a court can say that it does not comport with the Constitution. This is not the kind of question you can leave to Congress," end quote. Now, it takes a really special person to pack so much nonsense into a short paragraph like that. Justice Scalia is clearly talented at being a right-wing nutjob. It also takes quite a bit of arrogance and conceit, almost to the point, and maybe even all the way to the point, of megalomania. Now, when you consider that the last time the Voting Rights Act was renewed back in 2006, it was renewed by a vote of 98-0 in the Senate and 390-33 in the House, and all of those witnesses testified and all of that information and research was gathered. I mean, did Scalia talk to all of those witnesses? Did he read the tens of thousands of pages of evidence? Of course not. Moreover, his statement reeks of judicial activism. And isn't Scalia a member of that group that wants to restrict what the courts can do and goes around saying that the judges shouldn't legislate from the bench? Is the only exception to that for Scalia when he gets the chance to hurt black people and disenfranchise them? That's what it sounds like. Because the last time Scalia participated in judicial activism, back in 2000 in Bush v. Gore, it put the finishing touches on the disenfranchisement of approximately 10,000 African Americans in Florida. Scalia's statement is nonsense. He's not supported by the facts. And how he has behaved when the voting rights of African Americans is on the line is shameful nonsense bordering on racism. Justice Scalia, you win this week's Hall of Shame for infamous nonsense going away. And that's all I have for today's show. Thank you very much for listening. The next episode of Making Sense with Steve Laser will air live at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on Blog Talk Radio this Sunday, March 10th, and Monday, March 11th at 2 p.m. Pacific Time on KCAA Radio, 1050 a.m. in Inland Empire, California. Until next time, have a great rest of your day and a great week.